Good morning, Connecticut. To our friends across the Sound, it's John Voquette, Director of Public Affairs for Connoisseur Media. Thanks for tuning in to our award-winning public affairs program for the people, bringing you even more information to help address concerns in our communities tied to youth, the economy, public health and safety, aging, education, and the environment. We're going to open this week touching base with the founder of New England Young at Heart, a grassroots service network out of the Naugatuck Valley that's aiming to guide the elderly and their caretakers to enriching their lives with purpose and meaning. This statewide initiative is designed to inform local communities about the reliable, healthier living resources that are available to them. And we're going to share just a few of the upcoming activities planned, as well as some sound advice for those facing the prospect of having to care for an aging parent or a loved one. Then we're going to check back in with a couple of nonprofit providers that are involved in the statewide transitioning of individuals with physical and developmental disabilities from state-run to nonprofit group homes and other facilities. We're going to talk to the CEO of Oak Hill, which is engaging new clients across Connecticut, as well as a government advocacy specialist from HARC, serving hundreds of clients throughout the greater Hartford region. Finally, a few weeks ago, Safewise released its 20th Safest Cities in Connecticut report. So we're going to talk with a community spokesperson for the company about how Safewise calculated its stats and why it's so important for residents of the state's safest cities, and more importantly, everyone else, to be aware of some of the most important factors contributing to residents' safety and security. We'll be back with these segments and more on the award-winning For the People with me, John Voquette, right after this news. The Cultural Alliance of Fairfield County, in partnership with the Kuchma Corporation and Spinnaker Real Estate Partners, is pleased to announce a one-day space summit, Creative Spaces for the Creative Economy. It's coming up on Saturday, November 12th at the Bijou Theater on Fairfield Avenue in Bridgeport from 9:30 to 4:30. This summit is being held in response to calls for action by the cultural community in Fairfield County to bring unused space or underused space from throughout the region into more productive use for artists, cultural nonprofits, and others in those communities. There'll be a post-summit reception at 5 p.m. at the renovated Harrell Security Wheeler Building on Main Street in Bridgeport, courtesy of Bridgeport Historic Ventures. The summit is free of charge, but reservations are requested through an Eventbrite reservation system. You can learn more and link to register at culturalalliancefc.org. Well, we're always excited when we can talk to Ale Marcuccio. She is the founder of the Grassroots Senior Service Initiative and community now, that is called New England Young at Heart. It's a woman-owned business based in the Naugatuck Valley here in Connecticut, a network that not only serves as an umbrella of screened resources for seniors, but an electronic forum with tips, referrals, and local events geared toward the elderly. NEYoungAtHeart.com is the website if you'd like to call, if you have a question about a service, if you have information, if you'd like to find out about activities that you might be able to engage yourself or a senior loved one in, that's the place to go. 844-330-9898 is their phone number, or once again on the web, neyoungatheart.com. Elaine, thanks for checking in with us.
Hi, John. Thank you for having me today.
So, you've been with me now four or five times over the past few years, and I have to tell you, you are one of probably just around a dozen or two people over the past almost 30 years that I've been doing this who kind of got an idea in your head and put it to work and really made it happen and have caused that idea or that little seed that you planted to grow into a really wonderful product and service. Congratulations on the success that you're having with New England Young at Heart. I know every time I talk to you, there's hundreds and hundreds of more people that are contacting you, thousands and thousands more that are clicking on the website or on your social network. So for folks that are listening, beyond the introduction, can you just tell them basically a few of the real important things that you try to do for the people that come to New England Young at Heart?
Sure, and thank you for those kind words. It's always encouraging to know that I'm doing is making a difference in people's lives. New England Young at Heart is an online resource guide, but we're always out there in the community doing, you know, little interviews with people and the companies. I think it's important to spotlight the companies that are out there and getting involved and helping each other. And, you know, it's a collaborative effort, and that's what Young at Heart is about, just, you know, bringing these resources into the communities through programs like Becoming Your Parents, Parent, and also fun programs like our senior prom, which I'm sure we'll talk about a little bit later.
Mm. So as the program is going to broadcast here coming up on, where are we, the 23rd of October, what are some of the activities that you're now beginning to do? Events are becoming a really big part of a lot of organizations' ways of engaging the people that they either already kind of have in their network or to add new people to the network, make connections. It was a logical direction to go for you. You always, I remember, wanted to try to build a number of different activities that folks can regularly attend. What's coming up?
Well, we have a health and wellness fair that will be coming up in Woodbridge in December. And we have another one that we're working on in Wilton with one of their housing facilities, you know, for the holidays, more of a fun type of a, you know, still a healthy living, health and wellness, but we're going to do a little healthy cooking demonstration and some fun activities. And then we have, we'll be at the Branford YMCA next week doing some just fun activities for Halloween, handing out our newsletter and kind of a reverse trick-or-treat with some of our the other companies that are a part of Young at Heart. Mm. And then in April, we have a pretty big event that I'm planning, and I'm very excited about it, and we're having a senior prom, and that will be at Aria in Prospect. Mm-hmm. And we're going to have dinner and dancing. And it's during the, you know, in the afternoon, but you don't have to wear a prom dress or a tuxedo. But we're going to have the photo booth there, and it's just really going to. I'm very excited about this event. It's going to be a great event. It's a great event for, you know, again, everybody to come together. You know, you don't have to just be a senior. You can, your company can get a table, and that's what it's about, right? Building relationships in the community together.
Excellent. Well, I'm the thing that is so incredible is I'm on your website looking at your calendar, and you know there's pages and pages and pages of activity, and virtually all of them are absolutely free, including you know as soon as Monday tomorrow as we broadcast the program on October 24th you're having like a creative writing class. That's absolutely free. You've got a low vision support group that you have, bus trips, sports talks, book discussions, just an amazing array of projects and activities here. You're even advertising an investing basics for women course. You have certainly amassed an incredible array of partners and folks that are interested in being part of the Young at Heart network.
Yes, we have. I am continuing to grow and getting involved more and more, you know, with the nonprofits and the companies. You know, there's so many ways to give back, and there's so many ideas that people have that we want to, you know, we want to get out there and get them, you know, into reality. And even there's We're working with the Woodbridge Senior Center, doing some intergenerational programs, which is very important, I think, you know, for these students to connect with the aging community. And, yeah, people are, you know, we don't have to have all of the programs. You don't have to pay for them. You know, they're free programs, and that's my goal, is to get everybody on board and post your events and collaborate with each other.
And all of this is rooted in a very personal experience for you, if I recall, where you were a caregiver who so often was faced with the same kind of questions that I think thousands of the people that are listening to the program face if they are in any capacity providing caregiving or care for an aging loved one.
Yes. Yes, I grew up in a home where my mom took care of my grandmothers, and you know, my mom's grandmother and her mom, and now I'm a caregiver for my mom. And you know, I have my son with cystic fibrosis, and I just feel that the resources are available, but you know, it's hard. It's hard for people to find them sometimes, you know. And a lot of times you don't think that you're going to be eligible for certain things. And there's a lot of people out there that don't have family, you know, and they really rely on their caregivers or the agencies to guide them and help them. So, you know, for me, it really is. It's I'm very passionate about what I do. And actually, I was able to take part in the Valley Community Index report that launched. And, you know, it basically came down, it was for the, you know, for the Valley, the Valley report. But it's still across Connecticut, because it's all about, you know, aging in place, that people really want to age in place. And people don't have we do have the resources, but they don't know how to get them, you know, and they're underutilized. So we need to figure out a way together to do that. And I just really believe by, you know, networking and offering these programs, people in the community, individuals can put a name or a face to that company, you know, and when they need the help, they'll remember, you know, and they, it's very important to me, and I'm very passionate about my program.
Good. Well, we don't want to let you go without letting you impart some of your experience and wisdom to everybody that's listening this morning. And one of the big first things that you did as you got New England Young at Heart ramped up as a movement was hosting some workshops and talks that you labeled Becoming Your Parents' Parent. And now that has transitioned into being a blog on your website, which is neyoungatheart.com. Folks can just kind of scroll down the left column and click on that blog. But for people who are listening who are seeing a parent or their parents or an aging loved one getting to the point where they may need extra support or extra help, or they're fearful that they soon will, can you let the folks know who are listening, one of the most important things based on your experience that they could do to help ease that transition for that aging loved one?
Sure. They can absolutely contact me, and I can help to guide them, find, you know, the we could, you know, put the steps in order for them, what they need to do. And we can, you know, they really need to plan ahead, to sit down if their parents are able, you know, if they're still in a good place. Just don't wait. Just really plan ahead, and don't think it can't happen, to, you know, because it just takes one thing to happen, and people, you know, everything starts to spin out of control. And just try to work with your family, because I know for myself and my experience, it took a long time to, you know, get my mom to say she wanted to move, and then the move, and my family dynamics changed. So and I want to keep my mom, you know, have her socialization sure. is important to me. So if you, you know, if you can just, you can reach out to me and I can help you and point you in the right direction of who to go to. But really sit down maybe with your parents and your whole family and kind of map out a plan as to what your parents want and what their needs are. Because everybody's different. Every family is different. And, you know, like my mom, she's a tough bird. Mm-hmm. So it's not easy all the time. And it's very important for people to realize when they take on a role of caregiving, from far away or moving your parent in, just all the different things, you know, again, with the socialization and yep. how it changes your life.
Very good.
And we need to have a good balance.
Very good. Well, I appreciate your offering to take to personally help care navigate if necessary. But in the meantime, if folks want to learn more, they can go to neyoungatheart.com. If you have questions about healthy living, house and home, community resources, housing options, medical issues, even places to take or for your aging loved ones to go, as well as workers and contractors and their resource guide. It's all there at New England Young at Heart, or you can call toll-free 844-330-9898. Our guest is Elaine Marcuccio. We check in with her a couple of times a year, the founder of the grassroots organization New England Young at Heart. Elaine, thanks again for being part of the program. Well, as we have been talking for a long, long time here on the award-winning For the People about the potential for serving individuals in the state with particular special needs, those with physical or developmental disabilities in nonprofit arenas versus in state-run facilities. We talked most recently about the fact that the state has finally made a commitment to transition all of the residents in state facilities, or most residents in state facilities, to private and nonprofit providers for group home and other residential support services. And we also began a conversation a few weeks ago about the challenges that these nonprofits are going to face in regards to the state's reimbursement rate. So we're very pleased to welcome the first of a couple of guests that we're going to talk to this morning. Barry Simon is on the line with us. He's president and CEO of Oak Hill. Barry, tell us a little bit about your organization for folks that are tuning in from points outside your service area.
Oh, sure. Good morning, John, and thank you for having me. Oak Hill has been around for 125 years. We are a statewide organization. We have 125 sites that are in about 60-plus towns around the state, everything from traditional group homes, in-home supports, supported living, special education. We do 15 different kinds of services in those 25 sites.
Excellent. So, and how long have you been affiliated with the organization?
So I've been with the agency as the CEO for 3 years, but I've been in Connecticut doing services for about 25 years.
Okay, so this decision was something that was a long time coming, and certainly one that you saw merits of going back a quarter century.
Oh, absolutely. If you see the movement that has happened in both the combination of deinstitutionalization and, best practices in our services, you know, this is most other states have moved in this direction. It both provides high-quality care and gives flexibility in the way those services are provided, really helping participants integrate and into the communities, where they are. and you know, be a part of those communities living as independently as possible. Mm. That's why we have that continuum of care.
And I guess when we look at economies of scale, an organization as large and widespread around the state as Oak Hill is, you can really maximize every dollar to your best advantage. But that being said, when this new movement came about, there was this kind of huge sucking sound because the amount of reimbursements that the state was kind of beginning to talk around was actually going to be around the same or less than you were getting previously. Is that right?
Yeah, so, you know, it's kind of an interesting situation. So, you know, our staff are tremendous. You know, I have staff who are long, you know, have been here for, you know, 25, 35, 40. You know, I have one staff member we celebrated who, you know, has been here for 40 years. Every year we're celebrating probably 100 staff that fall into those, you know, kind of longevity slots. And, you know, the challenge for us is that we are unionized. In fact, we're the same union as the state, and, you know, we have really high-quality workers. But if the, you know, the state doesn't redirect some of those savings to, you know, pay livable wages and maintain continued quality, it becomes a challenge. I mean, we can save the state money in doing this, but some of those savings really need to be redirected, you know, back to our, you know, to be making sure that we maintain the, you know, the quality of service that we do.
Hmm. Are you finding some allies among the leadership and decision makers to that end?
Yeah, you know, it's been interesting. So, you know, like I said, I've been doing this for 25 years, and then having the discussions, you know, individually, there doesn't seem to be, you know, a tremendous amount of objection for anybody. You know, in, when you lay out the facts, you know, it's a really, it's a mom and apple pie kind of discussion.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you look at the houses that have been transitioned, you know, this is not a new process. It's just, I think, the finality of it. But the fact that this has been going on for years, we have many homes that have been transitioned, you know, over the years, going back to the closing of, you know, Mansfield Training School. There's been a movement towards, you know, the community providers providing those services with, you know, tremendous success. You know, even in the recent homes that have been moved, the participants have done better. If you look at the outcomes where you have negative behaviors, those have improved. Where you have health outcomes, you know, those have improved. So the measurable outcomes show that, you know, the care for the participants, you know, their quality of life is better. As well as for the family and guardians. I mean, I understand and certainly appreciate that it is anxiety provoking to be moving and changing relationships. But the reality is that it has been done over the past 25 years and successfully.
Hmm. That's great. Folks, if you just tuned in, we're talking with Barry Simon. He's CEO of Oak Hill, serving hundreds and hundreds of individuals around the state through their network of group homes and other facilities, supporting individuals with myriad disabilities. We are continuing in our series of discussions that we've really been talking about going back probably over a decade regarding the prospect of the state utilizing nonprofit providers to support these individuals instead of continuing to utilize state facilities. That decision has finally come down and it's happening here in Connecticut. So we're going to continue conversations with individuals like Barry about how that transition is going. Barry, about how many individuals, when all is said and done, do you expect to come into the network that weren't there before as a result of assimilating these state clients and patients into your facilities?
Well, you know, I'm going to give, you know, approximate, but
yeah,
you know,
yeah.
In these
dozens,
homes,
hundreds?
You know, there's probably about five individuals each, mm-hmm. You know, in the homes. There's, you know, in this particular round, you know, there's 28 homes. So, you know, you're talking, you know, not a tremendous, you know, amount of people, but, you know, a little over 100.
Yep.
And, you know, there's only a few hundred people, you know, left in the
right.
this part of the system. There are thousands and thousands of people who are already in the community part of the system. And the other thing that this, you know, puts out there is the possibility of even serving more people. I mean, there are thousands of people on the waiting list hoping to get services. So that this also presents an opportunity if some of these savings are redirected, you know, back into the system to provide more services to more people who are currently on the wait list.
So we could kind of think of it as if the state continues to spend as much money as it did in the former model, there is some potential for the nonprofit providers to get the additional revenue that they need to not only assimilate the new arrivals, but provide increased services for everyone within that arena, but also perhaps even make room for others who have kind of languished on the waiting list.
Absolutely. You know, you think about it, that, you know, there's potential here to have a win-win. I mean, you have the, you know, the governor and our elected officials who have been saying our employees deserve a livable wage, and this presents an opportunity where they could actually follow through on that and make that part of this this process, as well as providing more services to individuals who have been on that waiting list. So, yeah, there's a lot of you know, positive that might be able to come out of this if it's done well.
Thank you for steering away from the win-win cliche. although it is obviously in its best potential scenario, a huge positive move. Also, to clarify, is Oak Hill taking on just the people, or are you also taking over some facilities or group homes that were formerly completely administrated by the state?
So when we have done this, it's been a combination of both.
Oh, okay.
You know, there have been facilities that have, you know, been a part of the contract where the facilities were not of a quality that we would want to run.
Mm-hmm.
And so we have chosen to move the people out of that facility and move them into a better quality facility.
Oh, okay. Potentially.
And there also have been facilities that have been, you know, moved where people do stay in it. But in either scenario, we are working with a combination of the people who live there, the family members, the licensing, because we have tremendous oversight by the state. So DDS and Department of Public Health both, you know, come in and make sure that the facilities are, you know, of a particular quality to meet those standards. So some of the facilities that have been, you know, moved haven't been of a quality where everybody agrees that it's in the best interest to keep them. And others we have. So, you know, they vary.
Excellent. Well, we appreciate your input, Barry, and I hope that you're willing to come back and talk about it a little bit more because it sounds like with the size and scope of your network, you're a great person to tap. To keep tabs on how this is going kind of long term. So I don't mean to cut you short. We have another guest and voice to bring into the program. But I would like to visit with you again, perhaps for an extended period of time, or maybe even come out and meet you at one of the facilities and get a firsthand look at how things are going. So
absolutely.
Yeah.
I'm happy to do it and really appreciate your interest in this.
Yeah, in the interim, thank you so much for being part of the program this morning. We're going to take a quick break and we're going to come back to talk to Fred Stula, who's the Director of Government Advocacy and Community Affairs for HARC. But in the meantime, Barry Simon, President and CEO of Oak Hill here in Connecticut, thank you for all the great work you and your huge and dedicated long-term staff is doing, and we'll talk to you again soon. Do you love Connecticut? If you do, there are hundreds of nonprofit agencies, community groups, and grassroots causes that would love to have your support. You can learn about many of them through Love CT. Just go to our radio station website, hit the event guide tab, and click on to Love CT to help the many causes supported by Connoisseur Media. I'm Director of Public Affairs, John Voquette, here in Connecticut. We'll be back to the award-winning For the People right after this news. The AARP Foundation is looking to expand its team of volunteers for the upcoming tax season by recruiting interested individuals. TaxAid is an AARP Foundation program offering free tax filing help for those who need it most, especially adults 50 and older during tax season. Volunteer tax preparers complete tax preparation training and IRS certification prior to working with taxpayers. There's also a need for grassroots leadership, on-site greeters, those who can provide technical assistance, and interpreters who can provide language help. The program is offered at approximately 95 sites across Connecticut, including senior centers, libraries, and other convenient locations. You want to learn more and pitch in? Go to aarpfoundation.org/taxaid. We also want to remind you that Easter Seals is holding its 9th annual Ladies Night Out fundraiser Friday, November 11th from 5:30 to 10 at La Bella Vista in Waterbury. The event features over 50 vendors for shopping, a buffet and desserts, special drawings, door prizes, music, table games, and a silent auction. All proceeds provide services to thousands of infants, children, and adults with disabilities across Connecticut to help them live fuller, more independent lives. Tickets are available only in advance. No tickets are sold at the door. So to purchase tickets by credit card, call Easter Seals at 203-754-5141 or visit easterseals.com/WaterburyCT. All right, we're back and very pleased to be joined by a brand new friend. Fred Stula, as we indicated before the break, is the Director of Government Advocacy and Community Affairs for HARC Incorporated, based in Hartford. Fred, once again, thanks for joining us on a quick kind of shuffle here. For folks who are joining us from outside the greater Hartford area, tell us a little bit about HARC.
Yeah, so HARC's a nonprofit organization here in Hartford. We were founded in 1951, and we provide programs and services for individuals with intellectual disabilities and their families. And currently we serve over 2,200 individuals and their families every day. And
great. Mostly greater Hartford area jurisdiction or around the state?
Yep, greater Hartford.
Excellent. So from your perspective, tell me a little bit about how the transitions of clients to HARC from state facilities has been going for your organization.
Yeah. So really, a lot of these, you know, new programs that the state's been providing, they're transitioning them to private providers like HARC. So we've been going through and, you know, reviewing the opportunities to take on additional participants, you know, through group homes and through day programs. Mm. Right now we've got, you know, about 11 participants that have joined through for our day programs, and we're looking at, you know, potentially taking on some group home opportunities too.
Excellent. So can you explain to the folks listening kind of either the mindset or the differences that the individuals who have been with HARC from day one or early on in their lives versus the individuals who are coming in from some of these other facilities. We already kind of briefly covered, you know, the learning curve and the emotional concerns that both the individuals and their loved ones have. But do you find that once these individuals transition from the state, you're getting a feeling like if they didn't already know, they'd be better off? They're kind of getting it pretty quick.
Yeah. So I mean, the biggest challenge for anyone is, you know, when you're changing programs or you're doing something new. The most important part that I, you know, always kind of let people know about this is that park and community nonprofits, when we provide equal, if not superior, services to state programs, the biggest change is just there's going to be some staff changes. I mean, people have been with, you know, state providers for a very long time, and they've been having the same staff person there every day. And one of the transitions is going to be, you know, coming to a place like HARC, where you're going to have different staff people, or if organization like HARC takes over one of the group homes, it's going to be, you know, new staff members that are going to be going, you know, out there to provide the same services. But HARC doesn't really, you know, decide, you know, what level of service and the different services that people need. That's all from the state. So we're going to provide, you know, the same level of service that they're accustomed to. Mm. But it will be some different staff people that do it.
I understand that probably a majority of these individuals, not only whether they've been under state care for just a few years or for decades in some cases, you know, they're rooted in not only an environment, but a routine in that environment. And part of that whole kind of routine infrastructure is the people. Does it require, or did it require, at least on HARC's part, some specialized training to accommodate the need for your staff to account for those feelings of because they're serving new people?
Yeah, so that's something where, you know, HARC has new people that join our programs all the time. I mean, it's from, you know, people with intellectual disability, you know, have funding through the state, and they can decide where they want to go and receive programs and receive services.
Mm-hmm.
So new people come into HARC all the time. So our staff is very used to transitioning new people into our programs, you know, and also into our residential setups too. And we've got 11 group homes throughout Greater Hartford, and we have new people that transition into those homes all the time.
Mm-hmm.
So there's normally a real kind of a set process. People come and visit. They get to know each other. You know, it's just to try to make it more of an easier transition, because it's really important to us. And the level of care, and when anyone is moving into a new place with new people, we want to make sure that that's going to be a successful and a long-term placement.
Okay, you're drifting in and out volume-wise.
Oh,
if you
okay.
Can just make sure you're holding the phone close up. That's your microphone, and we want to hear all the details. So, with that being said, you know, from the level of an individual who's heavily engaged in government advocacy and building and maintaining relationships, I'd ask you the same question as I did our prior guest. From your perspective, do you feel that you have the allies in the legislature and in the leadership in Hartford to affect the types of assistance and support that you're going to need to not only continue to serve your clients and residents, but also your staff, recruiting and retaining to be able to have the payroll capacity, and then also to take on the new folks who are transitioning out of state facilities?
Yeah, so that's one of the big challenges that's happening right now. So we've been meeting with lots of legislators and leadership, and actually the candidates that are running for office too, to kind of educate them about the process and where we are, because this is actually a really historic time for people with intellectual disability. I mean, the state of Connecticut has been providing services for individuals for a very long time, and it's a very outdated model. I mean, throughout the rest of the country, you know, nonprofit community providers are who provide the services. And even in Connecticut, it's like 94% of services are provided by community nonprofits. So that's something where we're trying to get to that point where people understand that, you know, community nonprofits provide high quality care, if not superior to the state provided services. We're going to be able to do it much more cost effectively, you know, to kind of save some more money with the state. But the most important thing going forward is the sustainability of this, because, you know, community nonprofits are a partner with the state of Connecticut. And we're looking for, you know, our direct care workers to receive, you know, an adequate wage so they can continue to work here and make their career you know, serving individuals with intellectual disability.
Mm-hmm. And I can't let you go without kind of capitalizing on the whole community aspect, because I have to believe that every time a group home opens, there is someone out there that's opposed to it on face, in all likelihood because they're suffering with the stigma against what they think the residents and the facility is going to be like. Do you think that aside from all of the other benefits to both the agencies, the nonprofits, and the clients and their families, loved ones, and support network, that this move, like when you talk about historic time for individuals with disabilities in Connecticut, does this also play some small role in further integrating individuals into the community that may have a long-term impact on further rolling back the stigmas that some people still feel?
Yeah, that's a huge thing. And so one of the things that I did before I worked at HARC, I was the clerk for the housing committee. So I would have a lot of public hearings on stuff like this where, you know, there's going to be a group home placement. So I'm very aware of some of the challenges that people struggle with having a group home come into their neighborhood. Mm. The biggest thing that I've seen and the impact that it has is here at HARC, I have a lot of volunteers that come in too, and a big part is trying to change people's perception of individuals with intellectual disability. People with individuals with intellectual disability have a lot of abilities, and they're active and engaged members of the community. You know, they're going to be they're out at the movies, they're out working at the grocery store, you know, they're paying taxes, I mean, they're doing all these things. And I think people having those opportunities is the most important thing for individuals with intellectual disability, because they're not looking for a handout or anything. They're looking for equal opportunities that we all strive for, you know, every day. Mm. Those are the things that we provide at HARC, and that's one of the biggest things that we're trying to further within the state of Connecticut, and that's why we meet with so many legislators and get our families and our participants engaged in the advocacy process to help change that perception.
Excellent. Well, I'm glad to hear that, Fred, and it's great to hear about all the work that you're doing, the experience you bring to the table, and the success that HARC is foreseeing in this era as we transition away from state-run facilities for individuals with disabilities to private and nonprofit situations. Fred Stula is Director of Government Advocacy and Community Affairs for HARC, serving individuals, thousands of them, throughout the greater Hartford area. Fred, learned a lot. Thank you so much for taking a few minutes to talk with us this morning.
Absolutely. Thank you very much, John.
Well, something that's always on the minds of folks in Connecticut is their safety, the safety of their homes, safety of their family. And we were pleased to receive a outreach from our guest this morning, Sarah Brown, who's with SafeWise, a home security and safety brand committed to increasing safety education, awareness, and preparedness across America. And they come to Connecticut with their 20 Safest Cities in Connecticut report, which was just released. And to compile this report, SafeWise analyzes some important information to rank the cities, all of which have a minimum population of 5,000. So Sarah has joined us from Utah on the line this morning to kind of give us a little bit more background and break down some information and run down the list of those safest cities. Sarah, thanks for joining us on the program.
Oh, yeah, thank you.
So beyond that brief introduction, give the folks a little bit more background on SafeWise.
So SafeWise, we partner with home security systems as an affiliate program, and we create reviews of like home safety products, and then we come out with safety education, promotional, just general safety advice and guidelines for people. We have safety experts and analysts that factor into our reports and stuff like that.
So we got some stats from you ahead of our call this morning, and I'm hoping that you have those in front of you as well. Both, you know, which represents some good news for the people of Connecticut. Why don't you give us a breakdown on where Connecticut stands right now in terms of violent crime, property crime, and other points that Safewise is trying to make with this report?
Absolutely. The violent crime of Connecticut as a whole is actually 40% below the national average, which is pretty incredible if you consider how high the population the population minimum is actually rather high for most of our cities. It's 5,000. Mm-hmm. And states like bigger states in Connecticut, like Nevada and Utah, have ones that are like 1,500 or 3,000. Hmm. And the average population of the cities is 19,000 of our safest cities that we have for you. And so that's actually really incredible, because a lot of people ask me, I guess, in general, mm-hmm. what do we expect more smaller cities to be on these safest cities lists? Hmm. And essentially because smaller cities have less crime in general because they have a smaller population. But what we do is we normalize the data by doing violent crimes per 1,000 people and property crimes per 1,000 people, and that becomes our safety score for each state.
Okay.
And so Connecticut is just, it's a great example. The property crime rate is 25% lower than the national average as well. And so Connecticut's just one of those wonderful examples of large groups of people living together and still creating very safe communities.
Okay. So tell us how you go about crunching the numbers or even getting the numbers that you use to then run through your analysis to come out with the safest cities, the 20 safest here, specifically in Connecticut.
Yeah, so the FBI, every 2 years, they put out a new report, and so we take the newest report. This year's was 2014, and all of the cities that report their violent and property crime to the FBI, and the FBI essentially puts that in a table, and we take that data, and we normalize it by making it per capita per 1,000 people, mm-hmm. and adding violent crimes per capita plus property crimes per capita, and dividing it by two. Mm-hmm. And that becomes our safety score per state. And then we rank them. And essentially, the top cities that you see that meet our population cap are the ones that become the safest cities.
So are the only cities that are eliminated from consideration the ones that have less than 5,000 residents?
There are also cities that don't complete the data report fully, and so we can't use those cities either.
Okay. So tell us about why Safewise develops these reports.
Yeah, so like you said, our goal is to promote community safety education, awareness, and preparedness. Essentially, we want to be a resource for people who are moving to a city or a state, or to be people who live in those cities and states can be informed on where they're standing, and just to congratulate cities in general, because essentially these cities don't get congratulated a whole lot on a lot of things, but they really are knocking it out of the park in their rankings when it comes to being safe cities, and a lot of them have really strong communities and involved police forces, and we would like to congratulate them for that.
Well, let's snap back to Connecticut here and look at some comparisons across the nation. I don't know if you have this specific data in front of you from the Connecticut release that we got referred to on the web, but you had indicated already that violent crime rate in Connecticut is nearly 40% lower than the national average, with the property crime rate more than 25% lower. And according to the 2014 statistics, roughly 30 out of every 1,000 people across the country were victims of crime, while in Connecticut, it only affected 21 out of 1,000 people. But when you break it down further, And you look at the 20 safest cities, according to the Safewise study, only about 3 crimes were reported for every 1,000 citizens. So I guess when people are looking to relocate, whether it's in the state or from somewhere else in the country, that kind of statistic really makes an impact.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that people want to know that they're going to be safe in a city, and these cities that are reporting to the FBI, they report very thorough reports, which is why it is a solid report to go off of compared to any other place. Like, you can find state-by-state reports that can tell you more in detail what the crimes were and everything, but essentially, these reports give you, like, you could look up the, if you looked up the FBI data, it would tell you, like, how many of those were murders or robberies or different types of property crime or motor vehicle theft or something like that. So it's a pretty, it can give you a pretty detailed overview of the kind of city that you're moving into.
Very good. Well, of course, living in one of the 20 safest cities, according to the Safewise report, will likely reduce the chance of an individual being affected by some kind of crime. But Safewise also produces the Connecticut Safety Directory, which helps folks learn how to take precautions to better protect themselves and their property. So if folks want to get some additional details, they can go to safewise.com/blog/safest-cities-Connecticut. And that's where they could go to follow along as we roll through the 20 top cities. Do you have those in front of you, Sarah?
Oh, I don't. Sorry. I apologize.
Okay. So according to the report, we've got Ridgefield as the number one safest city in Connecticut, at least 2 years running, according to the report. Wilton, Weston, Easton, Reading, Suffield, East Hampton, New Canaan, Newtown, and Madison. Those round out the top 10. And the rankings for those are kind of split between being up from previous rankings or down from previous rankings. Like in the case of Madison at number 10, last year it was number 9. For the second half of the list, Simsbury is 11th, Portland 12, Canton 13th, followed by Plainfield, Greenwich, Middlebury, Monroe, Granby, Bethel, and then Cheshire. And it looks like the largest increase was in those numbers was for Bethel, which formerly was 23 and has now moved up to 19. So obviously you're in Utah as we're speaking to you this morning, Sarah, but when people think of most of the communities on this list, they do come out to be sort of suburban or bedroom communities versus cities. So do you think that, you know, for folks who live in actual cities versus more suburban towns, there's still some valuable information that they could get from looking over this report?
Yeah, I feel like a lot can be learned from the police forces in those areas. I think that that's something I want Safewise to do more of in the future, is to see what they're doing that makes them so successful. And honestly, you live there, so you could find it out a lot, probably more in detail and more in, better than I could. But I think that there's a lot to be learned about those communities. And one of my favorite safety tips ever is that you should get to know your neighbors. Mm. When you know your neighbors, they're more likely to report crimes or look out for your stuff when you're gone. And so I think in suburban communities where people know their neighbors more, it is more likely to find a community who is involved in each other's safety. And that's a really big support of creating the safest cities.
Excellent. Well, Sarah, we appreciate you taking the time to kind of run through this information with us this morning. As we indicated in our introduction, SafeWise, which is a home security and safety brand that works to promote safety awareness and education and preparedness in communities across the country and here in Connecticut. They released their list of 20 safest cities in Connecticut earlier this month. If you'd like to read the entire report and look at some of the other details and link to some of the other resources that SafeWise provides, you can go to safewise.com/blog/safest-cities-Connecticut. And I imagine in all the other states, just substitute your state for Connecticut after that last dash. And you can tune in, or if you happen to be thinking about relocating to another state, you can begin your research at that site just by substituting the state you're looking at for the word Connecticut in that URL. Sarah Brown is the community outreach spokesperson for SafeWise. Sarah, thank you so much for being part of the show this morning.
You've been listening to our award-winning public affairs program, For the People. The opinions expressed on this broadcast represent those of our guests and host and do not necessarily represent the views of Connoisseur Media. If you have a suggestion for a guest, an issue, or a community calendar item relevant to the audience and communities we serve, you must make a request for consideration in writing via email to me at john.voquette@connoisseurct.com. We do not accept pitches or requests for coverage by phone. Remember, no part of this program may be copied, disseminated, or rebroadcast. Our public file, reflecting the full scope of our station's responsiveness to critical issues in the communities we serve, can be viewed upon request weekdays during normal business hours in the New Haven area at 440 Wheelers Farms Road in Milford, and for our Hartford stations at 869 Blue Hills Avenue in Bloomfield. Our theme music is by Rick Miller and Scott's, with original music by Noel Viette. This is John Voquette, Director of Public Affairs for Connoisseur Media. Join us again at this time next week for more conversation and information on the award-winning For the People. Don't forget, you can listen to this and other For the People podcasts anytime on iTunes or under the podcast tab at our radio station's website. Until this time next week, thanks for listening.